Right, so close range remote sensing, high spatial and temporal resolution data. Specifically, I'm looking at my application in the geosciences. I should note my co-author here, Jim Chandler, who has helped a lot with the photogrammetry side of the research, which I'll show later. Just want to clear a few things up here. I'm not any of these people, in case you know any other Mike Smiths. I'm not Michael Smith, as much as I might like to be a Nobel chemist. I'm not the Challenger astronaut. I'm also not the ex-guitarist with Limp Bizkit, or Smithy, either. Something completely different, because I bought a book last week which has grabbed my attention. This is from Toilets of the World. It's a little bit off the wall, but this is the toilet at El Porvenir Airport in Panama, which grabbed my attention. Right, okay. Absolutely no relevance at all. It's a photograph. There we go. Right, so an introduction to what I'm talking about today. In the geosciences, we're often concerned with recording the location and distribution of phenomena of interest. So in terms of landforms, my area is glacial landforms. We're interested in looking at where they are, how big they are, size, shape, that kind of thing. That's almost at the lowest level, is actually seeing what is there and where it is. This can help us understanding history of landforms and also begin to understand how they are formed. And we would traditionally do this either by actually going out in the field and working out where these things are by walking around them, or by using remote sensing. And for those of you that haven't come across the term remote sensing, this is more generically termed a measurement of electromagnetic radiation by a device that's not in physical contact with the object. So the simplest form of remote sensing is just using a camera to take a photograph, because you're recording electromagnetic radiation. But there's a whole variety of other instruments you can use to do that. The example that I'm going to be using, which is how we've been testing some of this close-range remote sensing, is from physical geography, and more specifically glaciology, which is looking at glacial landforms in this instance. We've been mapping, as part of this, outlines of elongate hills called drumlins, and I'll show you a picture of these shortly. These are actually formed beneath former glaciers, or currently they're formed beneath glaciers, and those that we see in the landscape now were formed beneath a glacier in the past. And they form part of a generic group of landforms known as bedforms. So field mapping, when we're talking about looking at drumlins, is mapping drumlin outline. It's moderately accurate, not in the sense of surveying, you're not millimetric accurate, but in terms of working out where these are, their shape, it's moderately accurate. Because you're walking around these things, you can actually look at the sorts of sediments that they're composed of. However, because you're walking around these things, it's actually quite slow. Somewhere around 2 square kilometres a day is a sort of best amount of work you can do. As a result, it's also quite expensive, certainly in terms of labour. And because you're walking around these things, again, it's actually difficult to map landforms that are very large. Most of these things are on the order of several hundred metres in length, which is not a problem. The largest ones that have been picked out are 80 kilometres in length, so you wouldn't be walking around those. That's an example of a drumlin. This is from Scotland, just south of Loch Lomond. And this is a classical one, really, tapering towards the end here. This is of the order of 40 or so metres high, and so this is probably 600 or 700 metres long. And they're quite easy to see when they're like that. Many of these landforms are far more subtle. Sorts of output that we produce from these. This is an example of a geomorphological map looking at drumlins. uses a normal, or this one uses a normal Ordnance Survey base map. And all we're doing is marking the outlines of these features, the ridge line, or the ridge crest, and the highest point. When we move to remote sensing, we're using mapping that's based upon that's visible and near-infrared electromagnetic radiation, aka photos. So we can think of a normal colour photo. We can also think of using infrared, which has slightly longer wavelengths. The benefit here, of course, is that we have very large coverage. The largest single images you can get are around 600 by 600 kilometres in size. You can map 10 to 100 kilometres in a day quite easily, and it's very rapid and cheap. Of course, you're not actually in physical contact with what you're looking at. You're just looking at the reflectance of electromagnetic radiation. So you're only getting information on the shape of the features, not necessarily upon the sediments. Here's just a couple of examples. The other one I missed out there. So that's electromagnetic radiation. The other type of remote sensing you can use are called DEMs, where you actually have an image based upon elevation in the landscape. So a bit like a contour map, except we're using or viewing it as an image. I'll show you an example of that. So that's a satellite image from a part of Ireland, and you can see all of these little bumps and humps in here are these drumlins in the landscape. So this is 200 metres in length, so of the order of 2 or 3 kilometres across the image. And you can see a whole suite of drumlins in here. There's some quite long ones down here, some short ones here. There's another swathe coming through like this. And then in the middle here, we've got them cross-cutting. So we have a set like this and a set like this. So you get this regional view when you use satellite imagery. The benefit of using something like elevation is that you can start manipulating it in different ways. So this is an example again from Ireland, a different area. And this is an oblique view of these bed forms in here. There's some scale issues to think about when we start looking at these features. The actual acquisition of data is scale dependent. So thinking about the field mapping, we have quite high resolution data in the sense that we're looking at things very close, and typically we're looking at landforms between sort of 50 metres and 1,500 metres in length. When you move to remote sensing, you're typically looking at more moderate resolution data, more moderate size features, so sort of 300 metres out to as big as 80 kilometres in length. So there's an overlap there, but it's quite a small overlap, and what you're doing is you're sampling a different range of features in the landscape. So for glacial bedforms, it's pertinent to consider they're formed by a glacier, so we have a whole variety of different driving forces at different scales behind their formation. We therefore have several different processes that aid their formation, and we also have the scale at which we're actually mapping these things, trying to explain this. So we have a range of bed forms. It's important to note that they're usually formed at different times by different processes and at different scales, and what we see remaining in the landscape is an incomplete snapshot of what has happened in the past, and we then need to try to use that information to try to begin to unravel what's going on. In terms of landforms, I've identified three broad scales of features, certainly in paleoglaciology. There's things which I consider as micro features, which are of the order of centimetres in size, really. And these include things like striae and chatter marks, which are one to tens of centimetres in size. Mesoscale landforms, which are sort of metres in length, and there's a few there. This includes drumlins as well. And then we have macro features, which includes large drumlins all the way out to what they call mega-scale glacial lineations out at 80 kilometres. So we have different scales of features being formed, and we have different scales of ways of mapping these features. And this really just breaks down the types of things that we're looking at. So we have some kind of satellite platform looking at the landscape, a scale or in terms of image size somewhere around 100 kilometres, and we're looking at large features here. We have a mesoscale, and I've put in here as an example a kite platform, which is what I'll be talking about in a minute, up to a kilometre in size, often smaller than that, and they'll be looking at those medium-sized landforms. And then right at the smallest level, you can look at micro features, and just the example given here is something like a confocal laser microscope if you're looking at very, very small features. So we have different scales of observing features, different size features, and we're trying to bring all this information together. What I like to think of is that mesoscale remote sensing is currently a missing resolution. Fieldwork's often associated with micro and mesoscales, particularly the micro scales. Remote sensing is associated with macro scale or microscopic. And in remote sensing, we therefore have this middle scale, which we have very little data for at the moment, or not too much. Why is it missing? Well, we're looking at individual pixel sizes in our images of somewhere from 1 centimetre and at the most a metre, but we're looking at several centimetres really in size. And the way this is currently collected is either heliborne, just a standard helicopter, a low-level airborne survey from an aircraft. So to give you an idea of that, NERC charged something like $4,000 an hour for their aircraft to be used. Or something like a commercial satellite where we have 61 centimetres is the best we can get at the moment. And that works out at nearly $23 a square kilometre, if they have it for your area. None of these are low cost at all, and more importantly, none of them provide good temporal resolution. So you can't go back hour after hour or week after week in any meaningful way, in any meaningful low cost way with any of these other options. It's all going to be very expensive. So what other options are there for acquiring this mesoscale data? Well, balloons have been used quite a lot, telescopic masts, some kind of hybrid, and other examples include model aircraft, model helicopters, microlights, paragliders. They've all been used for capturing data. That's an example of a helikite, which is a balloon and a kite stuck together. Looks quite odd. That's just a straight balloon. This is by a company called SkyCell, who work for English Heritage, amongst others. They do a lot of indoor architectural surveys. That's a company called Elevated Platforms. They have a 15-metre telescopic pole for taking imagery. And my favourite is Pigeon Cam, which has not been used for a little while. So we've got a variety of novel methods for obtaining imagery. It's not a new problem, and kites and pigeons have been used for over a century for acquiring this type of imagery. Model aircraft have been used since the Second World War. The key to this is, firstly, actually before that, is that it's close to the Earth. So it's higher than, say, a platform that you can build. It's lower than a satellite or an aircraft, and it's that area that's a little more expensive to fly in using traditional techniques. And the key to these techniques is that they're very simple, They're fast to use and they're cheap to use as well. The first kite aerial photography was flown around the turn of the century in San Francisco. They needed a somewhat larger kite to lift the sorts of cameras that they used back then. But it's been around for a long time. So, some of the other options. Why haven't I been using them? Well, model aircraft, it can be difficult to acquire coverage for the area that you're interested in. If anyone saw Top Gear 6 weeks ago or so, where they put a car into space, they actually brought in a model aircraft flyer to do the flying. And it's actually quite skilled flying things like these. And to get them to actually cover your area of interest is more difficult than you might imagine. They have limited lifting capacity if you have a big camera, and there can be issues over stability as well if they're bobbing around in the air. People have used them successfully, but I don't think they're their ideal platform. Balloons are used extensively in a variety of areas. They're very, very stable, so they're very good for that reason. They're quite expensive to transport and refill. You're looking at about £200 to fill one of these things with helium. So they're not the cheapest thing. And obviously when it's windy, they're no use at all. So they're good in Mediterranean environments, and I think people have used them quite a lot in archaeology for getting close range photos. Telescopic masts are also quite useful as well. They're targeted particularly at estate agents for getting pictures of things like houses. But again, you're close to the Earth. Whether 15 metres high is far enough away depends on your application. So, some of the key benefits then for using kites to collect aerial photography. Modern kites have very high lift, even in low winds, and I'll show you how low that can be shortly. They're very simple, and they are relatively cheap. They're also highly portable. You don't have any problems in transporting kites through customs, and you can pack them in a bag easily. So they're ideal for field use. There's been a significant increase in the use of all of these methods, not just kites, during the last 10 years, and this has been particularly driven by the availability of a lot of low-cost model engineering components, some very innovative kite designs, and lastly, and probably most importantly, digital cameras. Up until this point, you'd have to fly your kite, take your photos, get the film process, look at them. You'd be lucky probably to get one or two good pictures out of a whole roll of film. Now I can send my camera up and shoot, say, 200 photos, look at them on site, and if I need some more, I can fly some more. So, some of the kites that I've been using. Modern kite designs are specifically designed for aerial photography, and they're designed to be very high lift and to maximise stability. These aren't the sorts of kites that you see doing stunts at on the beach or windsurfing or any of that. They're designed to have one string, they go up, they sit there, they do nothing. They're very, very boring to fly. There are two main candidates that have been used for aerial photography. Soft kites, which don't have a frame at all, and framed kites, which obviously do. So this is an example of one of the soft kites that are used. This is called a Flowform and is based upon a foil parachute design, which was originally developed around 30 years ago. They have these deep cells to provide the lift. I gather these holes in here and the fins at the back provide extra stability for the kite as well. So you get high lift, good stability. There is a slight problem with these kites, is that when the wind drops, the vents close and it falls out of the sky, which has happened on a few occasions. So which isn't very good if you've got an expensive camera hanging off the bottom of it. This one is called a Cat Pilot, quite similar to the Flowform. It's been modified slightly, and this is big. This is around this particular one that I use is around the size of a double bed, and will lift very heavy loads. in quite light winds. And then this is a third one, which is a framed kite based upon a design called the Pearson Roller. And they have a very good, well, they might have good life, they also have good lift as well, in very, very low wind conditions. Framed kites behave very differently from soft kites. They tend to have a much higher flying angle. So they're very good in tight spaces, particularly urban environments, where you certainly wouldn't be flying something like a model aircraft. The other benefit, of course, is if the wind drops, they actually sail down like a sail. So they land quite gently. And they can work in virtually no wind at all. This just shows an example of the sorts of areas where you would fly these kites. So down as low as sort of 3 miles an hour for the frame kites, and up to and over 30 miles an hour for some of smaller soft kites. The important thing is actually you need a kite designed for the wind conditions that you're in. So you do need several kites. If you fly something like that, or the Cap Pilot, which I showed you, in high wind conditions, it will probably lift you off the ground. So you do need the right kite for the right wind, because they have a lot of lift to these things. Again, if you've seen any of the kite surfing, well, they have surfboards, they get very, very, very high pull on those things. So that's the platform side of things. That's a bit like the aircraft. We now have to put some kind of camera on them to acquire the imagery. And for this, we've designed and built a rig. The rig design has an inner and outer cradle, which allows us to fully rotate the camera, pan the camera, and tilt the camera, so we can get it pointing at whatever we want. It's made from carbon fibre plate. I've done my spell checking on this. Which is very, very light, strong, and it's very easy to work with. There's standard model aircraft servos used for doing all of the panning, rotating and tilting, and receivers and transmitters are again taken from model aircraft parts. It also has a suspension system, which is a design that's been around for quite a while now in kite aerial photography, which I'll show you a picture of in a minute, but it's a laced suspension system that tries to level the camera, at least to a certain extent. So total rig costs are around £250 for all of the bits. And that's what it looks like. So we attach the line here. This allows rotation around the vertical axis. The camera is attached here. That allows panning up and down like that. And then this inner cradle can tilt up and down as well. So that shows you the camera. You can just see these strings which are laced here, which approximately keep the camera level. The line of the kite, the angle of the kite, will change depending on how strong the wind is, and this will just help level for that. Now, obviously, you can imagine that the kite isn't going to be perfectly still, and it isn't, so you will get swing in the camera. The benefit of having a digital camera is that you can shoot 100 photos. You can guarantee you'll probably get 20% where the camera is pointing at what you want it pointing at. Again, here's the suspension system, and here's the main kite line with the camera hanging off it. And then that's just the camera sitting in the rig. We're looking at about 1.5 kilos of weight for camera and rig there. So it's not the lightest thing in the world. Right, the camera itself. This is partly where my colleague Jim comes in. He's been doing quite a lot of research on using off-the-shelf cameras like this for aerial photography and specifically photogrammetry. If you were to go out with an aerial photography survey team, say from the OS, they would use a camera that would be about that big, and it would be sitting in a proper rig which will self-level it, and it will have a very, very serious lens on it, which will be fully modelled in terms of any geometric distortions in the lens. So they can account for that and get as high a precision as possible. Of course, we don't have any of that with a modern prosumer camera. So where Jim's work has been of interest is in looking at how effective these are, firstly for creating accurate results, and secondly how stable they are through time. The better the quality camera, the more likely you are to have a better final product. So that's why we went for a digital SLR rather than a small handheld camera. And the lens is perhaps the most important aspect of it. So again, we've gone for a fairly expensive Nikon lens to go with it. It's not the most, it's not the highest resolution camera around. This is a 6-megapixel sensor. So things are considerably better now. In fact, I think the highest resolution commercially available at the moment is around 40 megapixels, although that does cost a few quid. I have 2 gigabytes of memory on it, and we shoot it in either raw image mode or as a standard JPEG. There's two reasons you might want to shoot. First, you might want to shoot in raw mode if you actually want to record the actual radiation at the sensor. If you shoot with a JPEG, the camera receives that, processes it itself, balances the colour and the whiteness in the image, and then records it. So you lose all of the original information about radiation. If, however, you shoot in raw mode, it actually stores the raw values it receives at the sensor. So if you're interested in radiation, or recording radiance, then we would shoot in raw mode, and then we select a very fast one, a reasonably fast shutter speed, to minimise any motion blur of the camera moving. If you're just shooting to record a colour picture of the area, which is what we were initially doing with the photogrammetry we've been doing, we would choose a JPEG, set it to as high a quality as possible. We select a medium aperture, somewhere around an f8, which gives us a lot more range on the shutter speed. But what we don't want to be doing is shooting through the outer edges of the lens, because you get much more distortion on the edge of the lens. And then I tend to stick it in aperture priority, set at f8, and then the camera automatically selects the shutter speed for the scene that it's shooting. And we put manual focus on, set it at infinity, because we're usually 100 metres or so away, and we tape the lens to make sure that it doesn't move at all. So some of the initial testing, I've had 3 proper test runs over the last year, 3 flights, to obtain raw, and in terms of outputs from those 3 test flights, we were interested in obtaining just raw vertical or oblique photos. Secondly, we wanted to actually georeference the vertical imagery, so actually get some points on the ground where we knew their actual map coordinates of them were, and then correct the image with respect to the map coordinates. And then thirdly and finally, we wanted to create a full photogrammetric model using 2 aerial photos together. And again, for those of you who haven't come across photogrammetry, what we're doing is obtaining the geometric properties of an image, in this case a surface, determined from 2 photographic images. And there's a lot of very complicated maths that goes on behind that, which I would not profess to be an expert on at all about that. So we wanted to finally produce a photogrammetric model. And again, my co-author there, Jim, is the one who's been working on that final part. So we've had 3 test flights. And the first thing that we did was actually survey a playing field, which is obviously flat and is not very interesting. But we actually put out 20 control points, 20 markers on the ground, and we used a theodolite to survey in to one or several millimetres accuracy each of those control points. The software we're using has a would typically want to know the type of camera you're using and how it's calibrated. Look at the geometric distortion of the lens and anything else related to it. However, you can put it in a mode where it self-calibrates itself and then works out the model to accurately fit those control points, and essentially then spreads any remaining error between those. And you get a final RMS error in the X, the Y and the Z, which I guess is your first order in terms of the accuracy of the model. Once you actually have your final model, you can generate a digital elevation model, so you can calculate heights of points within your area of interest. And we did this for an area called Beacon Hill, and then we did it again for another area up in Loch Lomond near those drumlins that I showed you earlier. So that's the playing field, and you can probably just pick out some of these white dots, which are all our control markers which we surveyed in. This is Beacon Hill. This is a trig point at the top. There's the bits of one of the other kites, and this was the area we were surveying second time. So there's quite a lot more relief in this image. And this is an Esker up in Scotland, and there's one of the tripods there actually, for our region. The photogrammetric results were surprisingly good. We weren't actually expecting it to be this good. So here's our three survey dates, and we're looking at 10 millimetre or 9 millimetres, 8 millimetres and 38 millimetres based upon matching the control points. 12, 11 and 37, and then 9, 9 and 1 millimetre for the third model there. What's satisfying about that is that those three dates are quite well spread out, and the errors there seem to be fairly stable through that period of time. So the camera itself would appear to be quite stable, which is good. Here's an example of the Beacon Hill image. So this is the image that's been corrected for its distortions, and then all of these red dots are elevation points that the software has pulled out from the image. This is the same thing that's been done for the Scottish image, and then what I've done is created a 3D oblique image here and overlaid all of those points on those, so you can see the main ridge here of the Esker. So we've been quite satisfied with the fact that it seems to perform very similarly to how you'd expect it to perform in comparison to a fully professional camera from an aircraft. And the results it gets are certainly as good as we could expect. The interesting thing to note from this image, the algorithm that's used to generate these 3D points matches contrast between the two photos you work with. So if it finds an area of contrast, it looks on the other photo, and if it gets a very good match to that area of contrast, it then works out the elevation at that point. What you'll see here is that there's a large area in here with not many points in it. And again, you can see there are points, but there aren't a lot. This area was bare grassland, and then this is a track, a fence line. No, this is the fence line. And this is all gorse and heather, so it's not just bare grass. So there's various ideas for how we can tweak this to get better performance for extracting elevation in here. Obviously, these areas have got much, much denser elevation points in here, and so any surface model you create of this will be better than an area where they're much more spread out. One further area that we've been trialling has been with near-infrared, and it surprises most people in that a lot of digital cameras that you buy off the shelf are actually quite sensitive to near-infrared. And you can actually test this with your own camera by turning it on, so you've got the LCD screen on the back, pointing a remote control, the TV remote at it, and pressing the button, and you should see the remote control flash. which means that it's sensitive to infrared. My particular camera I tested in our lab, where we've got a dark room where we can fire different wavelengths of light at it, and it's pretty sensitive out to about 900 nanometers. In terms of visible light, we can see out to about 720 nanometers. So you get this near-infrared area, which is quite useful for remote sensing. We've briefly trialled it. We're going to be working on this a little more this summer. This is a tree canopy in red, green and blue. And that's the near-infrared area for that same tree canopy. And what's useful about near-infrared, particularly for vegetation, is that vegetation reflects very, very differently to near-infrared light in comparison to red, green and blue. Right, so just some conclusions to wrap up. High-resolution remote sensing has been easily achievable for quite a long time using both airborne and heli-borne technologies, but it's quite expensive. Mesoscale work is increasingly being used, increasingly important for work in the geosciences, and we never ever have much money in geosciences, so a way to acquire that in a low-cost manner is very useful. Kite-based platforms offer one solution that is low-cost, flexible and very portable, and high-accuracy results are potentially obtainable, certainly from our experimentation so far. Some of the key benefits, well, it's very high spatial resolution. That third flight in Loch Lomond was from around 150 metres in the air, so moderately high up, and each of our pixels are around 3.5 centimetres in size on the ground. Compare that with the best satellite imagery you can obtain at the moment at 61 centimetres, and it's obviously a lot better. You're not going to cover as large an area, but if you need to visit an area week on week or year on year, it's quite a low-cost way of getting high-resolution imagery. There's the potential for multispectral, as in capturing infrared in addition to red, green and blue. And this high temporal resolution, which again is very pertinent, we can do that. The cost of a repeat measure is relatively low. The example I use here is a proglacial area, so the area in front of a glacier, which during summer, when you see a lot of snow melt, changes very, very rapidly. So if you could go back every hour and just capture a new image, it gives you a very easy way of monitoring an environment like that.